Hello and welcome to Real Geeks. I am Crash and Burn, and with me as always is Mike Montgomery.
And welcome to what may be our most cursed episode since Dreamscape. Just scheduling this recording, my God.
Yeah, it has been a little bit of time and a lot of stuff that happened. I'm not really going to go into it because, but there was a nice vacation in there, so that's nice.
Oh, yeah, no, it's just...
I got a sunburn.
It's literally been everything from scheduling conflicts to minor dental surgery.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's been a fuck around, but I think that it is worth it. This one was a real special movie. I didn't know that going in. I had barely heard of it. When I saw the iconography and images of it, I was like, okay, yeah, I vaguely recall this. I think I thought it was a Disney film at the time, but I completely passed on this when it came out not too long ago. But dang, this is beautiful. Fuck it. Throw into the trailer. This is Wolfwalkers.
No children beyond the walls. The forest is brimming with real wolves.
You're a wolf walker. I met a girl in the forest. Who has magic powers. When she sleeps, she turns into a wolf. She's a wolf walker. Something's happened to me. Be a wolf!
This went into the list of important films to me because I am Irish descended by birth. Well, Irish descended through China. Stick around to the end of the show and I will try to remember to explain that one because, it's a fun one. To the point that I'm actually in the process of applying to the Irish foreign birth registry to get my Irish citizenship because I can.
Ah, neat. I think I'm too far removed from the last person who was Irish in my family for that. But yeah.
If you're at least a grandparent was born in a parent.
Oh yeah, I'm way too off. My grandparents were all born in parts of Canada, technically. Well, all right. My grandfather was born in Newfoundland before it was part. So technically Britain. Yay, not Ireland at all. Oh, dear.
So I had first heard about Wolfwalkers through Double Toasted when they did their review. And I was like, okay, I need to see this. And literally about 30 seconds, maybe less, into the opening of the movie, I am just sitting on my couch, utterly slack-jawed, like, this is the most beautiful animated thing I have ever seen.
Yeah, no, like it hits you immediately, and the way it does it is kind of subtle if you grew up watching some like classic Disney movies, because they used to have this painted look to their intros, but it'd only be the intros, kind of like how the Pink Panther movies would only have the Pink Panther, the character, in an animated intro. But then you realize, no, the entire film is in this beautiful kind of painted on semi-folk, semi-pop folk, like middle century art style that is, it looks hand-drawn because technically it is digitally painted with digital like brushes and it's just gorgeous. It is, every single frame of this is unique in the same way that you could like any frame of Samurai Jack was unique. It has roughly the same art style and like when I say the art style of this is beautiful, it's also very simplistic. Every character is practically an animation stereotype. Again, from like the works of Samurai Jack and any related kind of style like that, like the Clone Wars and all that. But there's something so... Have you ever watched like the extras on a Disney DVD and they're showing the sketches that they did early on, like before they got to the clean Disney style and stuff like that?
This is going to sound a little weird when I first say this, but this movie is my Spider-Verse. And what I mean by that is specifically that when Across the Spider-Verse came out, we were talking about over Messenger, and I you had said that like any frame of that movie you could put up on your wall as art, and mm-hmm. it would make absolute. That's how I describe this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Without a single moment of hesitation, because every frame of this is beautifully rendered in this incredible style and with this just free-flowing movement of art. It's damn it, this is a pretty movie. So this is directed and written by Tom Moore and Ross Stewart. I don't know who the hell those people are because they're Irish artists, and I don't pay much attention, unfortunately, to like serious Irish art. My bad. But they had previous, or at least Moore had previously made two other films in what is apparently the Irish folklore trilogy, The Yep. Secret of Kells and Song of the Sea, which I guess we're going to have to at some point see because
Oh yeah, no, we're going.
Damn, this is so cool. I've been meaning to
find those.
Yeah. Yeah, and like I'm fascinated to see what it is. What they're like, because as I said, I initially thought like way back when that this was just like a Disney movie. Oh, Disney's gone back to like hand-drawn stuff or whatever, because the designs are very Disney. Everything about this is very like stock character Disney, as yeah. I was saying earlier. Like they feel like stock characters. They feel like the prototype drawings that Disney animators do that later get like cleaned out and the stylization is toned down. This is the stylization at 100. Like this is full commitment to the stylization. And like there it's so communicative of so many aspects because the characters are essentially just pure stock. It says so much more and is so efficient in it. And like, it's half folklore, half actually taking place during a very specific time in Irish-English relations during the Puritan reign, and there's the Lord Protector in this, and it's just so funny because like that gives you so much more context for the character of the Lord Protector, but you look at him and it's just the villain from Pocahontas. He's literally like spitting image of the villain from Pocahontas, but then you realize like, oh, you know, these are essentially based on a prototypical stock character that the Irish would be very familiar with because it literally oppressed them. It's fascinating.
Oh yeah. And there are just so many themes here that are universal. I think officially there was like colonialism, especially toward the final act of the movie. There's Catholicism versus paganism that is just front and center.
Mm-hmm.
I mean the Lord Protector just screams Catholic Church.
Yes, and that's the funny thing. It wasn't actually the Catholic Church. It was the Reformation Puritan Church, which was so much scarier. But this is where like these aspects are brought in. The Irish themselves actually would have been Catholic. So like all the nice townspeople, they were Catholic, and the Lord Protector was a Puritan lunatic.
I mean, Yeah, frankly.
It's just, yeah, like, Irish history is ripe with repressions of all sorts of nature. And having that wonderful, like, the Celtish designs, the kind of naturalistic animus based designs and nature, you know, like nature be fighting this strict oppressive control. It's fantastic. And like the settings are all really well done. There's tiny little details in this. Like all the gold is beautiful. The magic is represented in this film. Like a lot of things are colored really dull in this, and then a couple of characters just pop out. That's really just easy and smart and simple to do, but many people forget it. But very specifically, the brightest thing in this is gold, and gold represents magic, and it like pulsates out of characters. It illuminates like doppelganger versions of them, like representatives or representations of them. It has like an electric crackle sometimes, and then it fills entire like forest with this ancient writing scrawled across trees older than time. And it's just this beautiful use of a simple choosing one color and having it pulsate throughout, not just in one way or another, but in multiple different ways to represent this interconnectivity of characters and location and like deeper spiritual meaning to the heritage of an area, in stark contrast to like the actions of another character and another force. So it's like environment versus action in that environment. It's and all that's just kind of like, you know, it's not stated or anything. You can see it and everything, but like this movie is so good at handling everything as subtly as needed while also engaging like on a purely childlike level. Like kids can watch this and work out, adults can watch this, and it's because it's like based in these mythological tales, it has a real history, it has like just a richer power to it. Like if you know the stock characters, you can invest yourself in the deeper meanings and cultural realities that are presented, and it really is just, this is a masterwork in terms of modern animation. And I'm just so perplexed that you don't hear anything about it, and that it only made like 18% of its budget back? 12% of its budget back. My bad.
Yeah, and also where this is actually, I believe, the first animated film that Apple Studios have picked up, and thank God.
Yeah, they should definitely do some more of this. And I assume they have, but then again, I look at the budget to profit ratio of this and wonder, huh, maybe that's why they don't do much of that, because it's been 3 years. Like, okay, yes, this came out during COVID, but the fact that Apple had it meant they could have like streamed it, meant that no one's getting residuals. No one's getting any fucking residuals from this. You're getting one of those 0.00 checks. Yeah, enjoy it.
Yay!
It literally costs them money to send it out.
But also stick with the conversation with the stock characters and so forth. I think a lot of the power of this movie is in its simplicity. In that, to go back to our escape from to a Witch Mountain review, where I had talked about how the kids are so well written because they kept it simple.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing here, where you have the lead child actor, the character of Robin Goodfellow, who's her main issue is she's struggling with the loss of her mother. She's struggling with moving to a new place. She's struggling with things like I just lost that train of thought.
She's struggling with like her identity as an English person within an Irish Catholic. Like she's an English Puritan within an Irish Catholic city, town, fortress, whatever. And there's a lot of pushback.
And she's also struggling with just the loss of freedom, because when her family lived in England, she could go wherever she wanted. She was allowed to travel with her dad on the hunts and help him. And with this move to Kilkenny, Ireland, she's lost all of that.
Yeah, she's now living in an oppressive situation where she is, to be fair, a part of the oppressive system. Like, you know, she's a child. She's not guilty of anything it does, but
yeah,
she is otherwise she would be a cog in it. She would work in the kitchen or, the scullery. I think it's the scullery, they say. And that would be her entire life, supporting with resources such as food and like cleaning stuff. The oppressive system that would be run by the Lord Protector and enforced by the menfolk. She's locked into this. She has absolutely no choice in the matter, because, of course, as we see, if you question the Lord Protector, he will fuck your shit up. And yep, that's historically accurate, because there was never a Lord Protector who wasn't a complete dickhead. That's how you become Lord Protector in a religious dictatorship. Anyway.
Yeah, and the simple fact is, name me one person whose childhood did not involve at least struggles along some of those lines at some point.
Oh yeah, no, it by hitting a few vectors instead of just focusing on one, they make it a broader, richer character that so many people can buy into.
Our other lead child character of Maeve, whose storyline is she's trying to find her mother and essentially put her family back together.
Yeah.
If you're a child of divorce.
And there's other levels working here. Maeve is a traditional Irish name, if I recall, for a goddess or at least a warrior queen.
Yeah.
So a force of nature, something that cannot be tamed, cannot be controlled. And she's very much that. You know, it's a very straightforward, here is what the character represents and is. And Robin Goodfellow is the name that at least Shakespeare, if not other yep, people at the time, gave Puck. And so you already have a character who is like, they're going to be impish. They're going to be trickstery. They're going to have a reputation for breaking the rules. And that's what you can expect of them, and the unexpected outcomes and stuff like that. And it's like just loading it up with that. This is so packed with information on so many different levels. And I'm not even like familiar with the myth of it. So there's something else to go and unpack that I'm sure is way more brutal, because almost every single myth that is turned into a cartoon is. Holy shit.
It is like based on Irish werewolf myth.
Werewolves of Ossory?
That's it.
So the legend, this is from Wikipedia. The legendary werewolves of Ossory, a kingdom of early medieval Ireland, are the subject of a number of accounts in medieval Irish, English, and Norse works. The werewolves are said to have been the descendants of a legendary figure named, Leinech Felad, whose line gave rise to the kings of Ossory. The legends may have derived from the activities of warriors in ancient Ireland who were the subject of frequent literary comparisons to wolves, and who may have adopted lupine hairstyles or worn wolf skins while they went wolfing and carried out raids. So, yeah, just, a couple of murderous Irish ancestors. It's all good. It's just like anything else. Literally, just...
Murdered for a good cause.
Yeah, why is mine... Why is my last name what it is? Well, because a bunch of your ancestors who are Irish like to kill people in a certain style. Neat.
Yep.
Okay, then.
But, yeah, like I said, the children characters have themes that and struggles that children actually have to deal with.
Yeah, and they have such a fantastic back and forth chemistry of, yeah, no, that makes complete sense. Like, it's two kids who ran into each other and immediately just start being best friends. And the chemistry is there. They're well written. It doesn't feel forced. It just kind of works, even though, again, all of it is cliches. It's cliches on cliches on fucking cliches. They meet with a misunderstanding, but share empathy over a hurt bird. You know, like, there's just basic character level things that are ancient in this story. There's nothing new here, and that's what makes it work. I think it's the smartest use of myths and general story cliches without trying to have something like new. You know, the newness is the artistic representation of it, the infusion of a specific historical perspective. Everything else about this is, like, as I said before, it's so stock, it's so basic. It's literally using a character from A Midsummer Night's Dream as the basis for its main. It's so wonderfully perfect and concise and Alan Moore-ish.
I just want to tell a nice children's story, but also, you know, the violence of the Reformation.
Just a quick note to add to the chemistry between the two kids. Apparently, they did record their lines together, which isn't necessarily a common thing in animation.
But having, like, I assume that they cast kids for this?
Honor Neefsy, who played Robin, was, I believe, 12 at the time of recording.
Mm-hmm.
And Eva Whittaker, who played Maeve, was 8.
Okay, that makes complete sense, because that's how you get that chemistry, that energy, the back and forth that works so well, even in animation, because you can't... Like, a really good actor can fake it, obviously. But at the ages of 8 and 12, you're asking a lot. So, yeah, having them record together, that's really fucking smart.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And also, just speaking of asking a lot, and particularly with a lot of what we see out of Maeve emotionally and what Whittaker has to do as a result, at the age of 8, I would like to note that this was apparently... This was her first ever performance.
10 for 10. Quite good. If you can nail such a fundamental character that, like, on a very basic level, this is just the Epic of Gilgamesh and Enkidu. And she's Enkidu. And she's one of the best Enkidu I've ever seen. At the age of 8. Which kind of makes sense.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, like, just the amount of heavy lifting she's having to do in her first job ever.
Yeah. No, if she wants to continue, she's got a bright future ahead, because holy shit, you can act. Speaking of actors who are capable, Sean Bean's in this.
And doesn't die,
but this movie is very good at creating stakes that you swear to God, oh no, this we're gonna get heartbroken. It has a happy ending. There is no heartbreak, but it likes to come so close. Like that mother, spoiler alert, the mother dies at one point, but it's okay because magic brings her back. But she dies at one point, and there's a moment when Sean Bean's about to get shot in the head, and you're like, well, it is Sean Bean. I liked his character, but I guess he's got to get shot in the head now. And you buy the tension of this children's movie because, again, they rely on a stock concept. I'm not feeling necessarily tension because the wolf is not paying attention to the gun being pointed at the man's head. I'm feeling tension because that's Sean Bean. And yes, they're going to fucking kill him. And then they don't. And that is that alone. This is so smartly put together on like every possible level they know exactly what everything means in, like, I don't mean like, oh, you know, like in a straightforward, here's a definition of it. I mean like a Rubik's Cube of meaning for every single piece of this.
And also, just the use of foreshadowing. How, I don't know if you caught this, but they kept at appropriate times working in the phrase, there's two of us now, mm-hmm. or some variation of that. And then right at the most dramatically appropriate moment, it pays off in saving Maeve's mother. Which also, side note about Maeve's mother, if you're a fan of Orphan Black, you are going to be very happy, because that's Maria Doyle Kennedy, who played Sarah's adoptive mother, Siobhan, on Orphan Black.
She barely has any lines, but enjoy what you get.
Oh, yeah, no, she doesn't have a lot of actual lines, but they do also make use of the fact that Kennedy is also an accomplished singer.
Yes. Yeah. but yeah, like the there's two of the us now thing comes up even after that. Because yeah. Now there are like the kids become sisters, like essentially, and then also probably in a more formal way, because also the mother and Sean Bean seem to at least hook up, if not themselves romantically, then to create a family situation, like a mutually beneficial family situation. Plus, they're all fucking werewolves now. So, like, you know, they're probably going to stick together. I think they're a family now. And there's two adults and there's two children. There's just, it's tiny little things that reverberate. And it's like, oh, wow. This was really, really, really well put together, and I can understand why it probably took the better part of a decade to make this movie, even though the digital process would have been faster than the traditional animating process. I'm not talking about that. Although, holy shit, you know, again, every frame is perfect. I'm talking about just how well built it is on so many tiny independent levels. Like the townsman, I believe he's a sheep farmer. Who gets locked up.
Yeah, I was going to say, the dude of the gallows, yeah, he's great.
Yeah, he's great, but again, he's a basic stock character. He's meant to be as friendly as possible.
Yeah.
He's, design-wise, he's Mario without a hat. It's just wonderfully smart shortcuts without feeling like shortcuts. The two idiots who hang outside the city gates, the food gets stolen from, their designs are so basic, but they're basic in a way of like a Muppet, where they're entirely unique. Yeah. All of the design elements are perfect, but you can't help think of any other way that this character would look except these basic proportions, this general idea. And across any art style, those general ideas would carry no matter who was designing them. Like, they jump off the page fully formed as they appear in the cartoon. It's perfect. This is like a perfect film that is very, you know, like the storyline isn't complicated. The character arcs aren't like grand or very like in depth, but it's like a perfect children's movie. A perfect fairy tale in that sense.
Oh yeah. Like there is only one way that I could accept a live action version of this film. And it is a way that is not possible to do, because you have to bookend it with John Hurt, and it's a cinematic version of the storyteller.
Ah, I see. Yeah, I can see that. I'm really happy, like, speaking of semi-mature storytelling, I'm really happy that there's no like quest for the cure in this.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't end with a question of will I be cured or will I embrace it? No, it's just you are a werewolf now. That's it. That's your future. Learn to deal with it. Cope. Use its new tools and techniques for your own gains. But this is a fact that you're just going to have to deal with. And when her father becomes one, there's no like, there's no moment of hesitation of, oh God, we're monsters. It's just, yeah, I guess we're this now. And I find that a really fascinating approach that is just, of course, buried in like the Irish psyche of an approach, I suppose, to a wolf walker, where it's like, or rather magic in general, where it's like, if you get, if magic is done onto you or you get like a spell put on you, you're pretty much stuck with that.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of an approach to fate of, well, that's what you get. And I like how they just roll with it instead of making it a further struggle that would just, it would be needless because first of all, you get wicked superpowers. Second of all, it makes the characters more interesting and more tied together if they stick with this. And third of all, it gets rid of that nasty eliminationist argument. So, yay.
Yeah, and frankly, there's already enough struggle in this movie.
Yeah, it would just be needless tacked on conflict that wouldn't actually grow any of the characters. It just seems like it.
Three quarters of this movie is Robin struggling to be heard by her father, which was so frustrating and was driving me crazy, but narratively in a good way.
Mm. Whereas, yeah, if you added on a personal struggle within, it would undermine the confidence that she has throughout. She's full of confidence. She just happens to be very, very, very small. And thus, anyone who disagrees with her can literally just move her somewhere else. This is a movie of Robin getting moved to different places.
Pretty much.
Pretty much against her, you know, pretty much against her will the entire time.
And then when she finally tells her dad that she's a wolf walker, like, we've already seen her struggling with this so much that she's trying to conform so much to the point that she will not let herself sleep for fear of changing.
Yeah, which is just, and yeah.
That moment, all I could think was, can't sleep, clown will eat me. Can't sleep. Clown will eat me.
I had the same thought. And yeah, it's just, I don't know. Inescapable 90s brains. We're doomed.
Basically.
All of our last words will be quotes from The Simpsons. We're fucked.
But then when she's finally just like, I am done with this. And it's like, no, Dad, you're not killing this wolf. And finally says, I'm a wolf walker. You have to accept this. There's almost a moment. It almost feels like she's coming out.
Yeah, there's, yeah, and it can work for that. It can work for a lot of different things. Like just basically standing up for yourself and your own personality. It can be a coming out story. It can be, it's open and yet it isn't, you know. It has some very strict and straight interpretations and then other options that are fully available and are not contradicted at all. It's, again, this is really well and smartly written and done so that the viewer, who specifically like a child, can interpret it however works best for them without undermining the character at all.
Yeah, it's this beautiful, it's whatever you need it to be. And Hollywood, can we do this more often, please?
This movie immediately, but especially throughout, like literally throughout, reminded me of one of my favorite, I guess, hobbies? Yeah, let's call it a hobby. I collect, if you can say collect in the terms of like, they're all digital downloads, but I collect art video games. Like, any video game that seems to be an independent, really interesting, smart idea, or clever, or different, or just really beautifully artistically presented game, usually under $10, yay, I just devour it. I love it. I download any I can find. I have a video game version of Walden by Thoreau. For those who are unfamiliar, Walden is about staying in a cabin by a pond and just learning that you're okay without civilization. That's the game. You go outside and inspect a tree. That tree is very important to your narrative journey. Nothing of conflict happens. You have to spend entire weeks and months in this cabin and in the surrounding area, and all you do is kind of ruminate on nature.
I was literally just gonna ask, so it's like a more meditative game.
Yes, exactly.
Nice.
And that it's based on a meditative book that was like the beginning of the naturalist and conservation kind of genre and idea of just like, you can get out of the city and chill. Who the fuck knew? This was a revolutionary concept at the time. But this very much, I wish there was a way to turn this into a video game in some way, because I know that the assets are digital and it would be so easy to map somehow onto a game, because it just looks like the prettiest fucking video game ever. Like, not all animation looks like a nice video game in that sense. There's something about, like, as I said before, like the simplification and dumbing down of designs, the pulling back from the oddities and the irregularities and things. But those irregularities really, I feel like, thrive in video games. It's kind of like an aspect that makes things interactable and definable in the physical space. And it's just, by keeping it, all I want to do is pick up a video game controller when I'm watching this and start randomly pressing buttons.
Well, and frankly, first of all, agreed. Like, that is something that I would play with in a heartbeat. But I think I can probably explain at least part of that feeling. Because the wolf vision sequences were, if I remember, were designed in like a 3D VR.
Detective vision. Yeah. Bat detective vision.
And then, according to an interview with IndieWire, the wolf vision scenes were pre-visualized and built in a virtual reality environment. Rather than simply keeping those scenes to the virtual reality engine, the animators printed out the 3D model frame by frame and reanimated all of it on paper with charcoal and pencil.
Nice.
This gives the scenes a uniquely three-dimensional feel while still being hand-drawn. And while I'm generally always just so grateful when an animated property changes styles before moments like this, fuck, this is beautiful.
Yeah, and it works. As I said, it feels like you are moving through a physical space in a manner that makes watching the entire film feel more like a video game. Even the use of backdrops and distance backdrops for horizons feels like the layering of a video game rather than a cartoon. And maybe that's simply because we don't see as many high quality animated cartoons that would rely on those traditional methods, but they're alive and well in video games, where you're operating in a physical space that has been defined by the program, and you have to approach it by like stage logic. Your background is back here. It has borders that you can't see if you're in the proper gaming area. You know, you might have a tower there, but it extends below the floor a little bit, and it might just be flat. But from this perspective, it looks real. I love the kind of staging that by being a digital asset this shares with video games, and it just makes it feel, like a wood graining, like a woodcut thing, like physical art you can get your hands on. It makes it feel like a pop-up book. It far more than just its basic art style that is common with like children's pop-up books, but the layering it's not like obnoxious layering where it's like saying, oh, these are cardboard cutouts layered on top of each other. It's subtle in the same way that the Simpsons animation used to be, where now you can see the layering of aspects, but beforehand it was done. It's probably because the TVs were so shit back then, but it was done in a way that made it seem like one single animated, like every frame is fully animated at the same time. Sometimes cartoons are really bad for that. Sometimes video games are intentionally bad for that to create a sense of space. This toes that like middle line, that golden ratio, the fucking diamond peak instead of the uncanny valley, where everything just looks perfect in that it is entirely flat and yet somehow like 3D animated and feels like it has weight and depth to it. So well done.
And also I think about the only thing we haven't hit at this point is the soundtrack in this movie that, again, glorious, glorious artwork.
Yeah, the soundtrack didn't hit me as well, oddly, but I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just like, if I'm watching like a Disney movie and it has like a main song, that main song usually gets stuck in my head. Nothing from this got stuck in my head, but it was all like, it's more like, oh, I'm just not into this genre. You know, you can tell the artistry of it. It's just not for me. But it makes complete sense with the film. Yeah. I don't know why it just didn't stick with me, but it works. I don't know what my problem is.
Well, like, this is the thing. It's there is no main, like, title track, and I'm kind of glad there isn't.
Again, it kind of comes back to like sort of how you would have to do environmental music in a video game. It doesn't
exactly
repeat itself like some films do once they get a melody and it's like, we're gonna beat this theme into the ground.
Yep, yeah, like there's no Let It Go, for instance.
I mean,
like, really, what's a more obvious example? But instead you get things like the scene just after Robin transforms into a werewolf for the first time and meets up with Maeve, and Maeve in the pack. And also, quick side note, just how the animators continually would draw the pack as like one giant entity.
Mm.
Again, thank you. Nice touch.
Yeah, no, that was very, very well done. Very sleek, very movement oriented.
But that whole kind of wolf training sequence, paired with a song, I think called "Running with the Wolves Tonight."
Mm-hmm.
The song itself may not necessarily stick out, but all of it put together, if you didn't really want to be outside after that sequence, I have questions.
Yeah, it's a, like, again, it didn't really click with me in the sense that I, like, I'm aware of the song and it worked, but I can't think of it. Like, it's just not, it didn't get stuck in my head. But that it worked at the time so well,
yeah,
that
it's exactly.
Just, yep, that's the point of this sequence. Again, it just shows the efficiency and effectiveness of it, where it's like, it might as well have been any other scene, but it's a fucking song in a cartoon. If it's not going to work perfectly, like, as in you remember it, it usually is disruptive. And you're like, oh my god, why are they singing this, like, typically it's a cover of some song that was popular in the early 60s or 50s. And it's just, shut the fuck up, shut the fuck up, shut the fuck up. But
yeah, I was just going to say pretty much any song DreamWorks has picked for any of their movies.
Exactly. You either end up with DreamWorks songs, which are just hateful things, or you end up with a Disney song that gets stuck in your head for the rest of your life. This one seemed to have done it so well as just kind of like, again, that perfect borderline. It's neither offensive nor catchy enough to fucking ruin your life. It just is, and then it's gone. It serves its purpose and moves on.
Yeah, it's absolutely it's that perfect. Neither element works by itself, but once you put them together, you've got that cinematic peanut butter cup of goodness.
this was a fantastic film, and I can't wait to at some point get around to seeing the previous two, which I don't have massive expectations in terms of the art style. Again, I'm sure it'll be great, but like, this was done, I feel, with the largest budget they were able to get, and of course the more recent technology.
Yeah.
But who knows what awaits us? Maybe it's paper mache.
Oh yeah, like it might be simpler, but we've already seen that this studio is capable of quality work, and Secret of Kells is already something where you may not have seen the movie itself, but you've more than likely heard the name at some point. Which, like, even just that probably says something about the quality of that movie.
Yeah, yeah. It just pops in my brain as a title that's like, oh, I think I heard of that, like, years ago as getting awards for being an international film. It has a very international film title feel to it. And hey, it is. So yeah, I can't wait to see those. If you have not seen this film, go watch it immediately. I'm not sure if it's still available on Apple, but I know that you can find it online in other ways. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Me hearty RR.
I mean, listen, obviously, we would prefer that you support the film via legal methods. That being said, as we have been stressing repeatedly, this is art, and art needs to be consumed. And, okay, I'm literally looking for it right now on iTunes, and ooh, there's a graphic novel. Nice.
Ooh, yeah, there is a
Art of Wolfwalkers digital book. I see the soundtrack, and I don't know why it didn't actually search for the movie the first time. Okay, weirdly, from what I'm seeing here, it almost looks like you can get everything but the actual movie, at least in the iTunes store.
So I don't have get your merchandise.
Apple TV at the moment, but like, just the soundtrack. Each track is about 99 cents, and apparently there's also a cover of Running with the Wolves that I kind of want to check out, because I have an Apple Music subscription, and I don't know why I haven't already downloaded all of this.
So yeah, you can get all the merchandise, none of the movie.
Come, walk this way, take a look. We put the picture's name on everything. Merchandising, merchandising, where the real money from the movie is made. Spaceballs the t-shirt. Spaceballs the coloring book. Spaceballs the lunchbox. Spaceballs the breakfast cereal. Spaceballs the flamethrower. The kids love this one. Last but not least, Spaceballs the doll. Me.
May the Schwartz be with you.
So, that was a fucking joy. What are we watching next?
The official end of the list that was supposed to have stopped about 4 or 5 months ago.
Lol.
The third of the films that I consider just pure, unadulterated art is, I believe, actually the first stop-motion film that I saw in theater, which is Kubo and the Two Strings.
I've never heard of this.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've never heard of this. The first stop-motion movie I ever saw, I think, was probably Nightmare. So, yeah. Well, that another one that will surprise me.
Oh, I'm so looking forward to our next recording now.
And if you are looking forward to the next recording, because, like, seriously, it has been a while. Sorry, it's been complicated. You can contact us at...
By email at realgeekshfx@gmail.com. Or via Twitter at RealGeeksHFX, which will also be the place to go the next time life decides, no, you're not allowed to record for at least a month. I can be reached directly at the Maritime Lord. You know what? I'm just going to say pretty much everywhere, because at this point...
it just is.
Or via email at themaritimelord@gmail.com.
And I am on Twitter, X Twitter, Xtreme, excessively stupid, under @FridayInHalifax and Crash and Burn, quite literally everywhere else. Maybe not Pinterest. Do I have a Pinterest? I can't fucking remember.
A quick side note, I think we need to go by my assertion that no matter what Elon Musk says, we're still calling it Twitter.
Twitter. Yeah, no, we're not. We're not making X a thing. X will never be a thing.
Nope.
Stop trying to make X a thing. Until next time, X is not a thing. Goodbye.
See ya.